Greetings, this is James Gillen with As You Wish Talk Radio. We've got some crazy events going on. Just getting hooked up to do the show was quite an event. But there's some crazy energies flying around. And I know we've got Mercury retrograde. I think Mars is in retrograde. And we got quite a few X-class, M-class flares. And the sun's doing some crazy events. And I'm trying to track something down, but I think we actually had some kind of an incoming energy that came in, like like a nova. Yeah, some kind of a supernova or something. But I don't know what's going on. But my guess, Joseph Selby can probably shed some light on this. He's an author, speaker, educator, and he's one of the world's foremost authorities on the cycles of time known as the Yugas, with more than 30 years of study and experience in the field. He's the co-author of The Yugas, Keys to Understanding Our Hidden Past, Emerging Energy Age, and Enlightened Future. He studied ancient Western cultures at the University of Colorado and ancient Eastern cultures at UC Berkeley. Since the late 1970s, he's taught and lectured throughout the U.S. and Europe on the Yugas and the principles of Eastern philosophy. Selby's also the founding member of Ananda, a worldwide spiritual organization with seven communities worldwide. And without any further ado, we want to welcome Joseph on the show. Joseph, are you with us?
I am, and thank you for having me on the program.
Oh, welcome. Yeah, I have a real strong fondness for Babaji and Yukteswar, and they've played a very strong part of my life. I had Yogananda pop in once, and that was about it. But other than that, it's been quite a journey. But basically, this is all about your journey, and I'd love to hear more about the Yugas and basically what's going on.
Well, it's in terms of the Yugas, we are in a upswing. For your listeners who may not be familiar with the Yugas, they're a 24,000 year cycle of human development based on an Indian tradition, but in particular, as it is expressed and explained by Sri Yukteswar, whom you just mentioned. Sri Yukteswar was the spiritual teacher of Yogananda, and Yogananda was the author of Autobiography of a Yogi, which I think millions of people have read and many, many people recognize. But Sri Yukteswar's contribution to this subject is really just a very kind of clear expression of this 24,000-year cycle that we go, and mankind as a whole goes through ages or yugas. They mean the same thing. A yuga and an age is the same thing. And that as we move through these different ages, mankind's consciousness changes, and as that consciousness changes, new abilities come in, such as mental telepathy and even in the highest ages, the ability to directly experience spirit. So right now we're in a fairly lower age, although not the lowest, happily. We just passed through the lowest age called Kali Yuga, and we're now in what's called Dwapara Yuga, or the energy age, where mankind has become aware of energy. And that's really the keynote of our time, is understanding energy as the foundation of matter, the underpinning of matter, and more importantly for us as individuals, understanding that subtle energy, life force or prana or chi, is the foundation of our physical body. And that these sort of twin awarenesses, one of the sort of outer world and the other of our inner world, are the keynote of this new age that we're in. So it's a good time to be here, because we're getting to discover a lot of potentials that up until 100, 200 years ago weren't commonplace. We see a lot of new wisdom emerging around mind-body medicine, around healing through freeing up the channels in the body, like with chiropractic, and interesting, fascinating to me. It's part of the reason why I wrote the book, The Yugas, and why I'm hosting a conference in the spring, is that we're seeing a connection to these same abilities as they were expressed in the ancient past, and those are coming through into the present in the form of yoga, meditation, acupuncture, a lot of traditional Chinese medicine. If you look into the history of Egyptian medicine, it's a lot of it is energy-based, subtle energy-based. And so this connection to the past is happening because we're now moving into an age that shares the same consciousness as that ancient past. So we're seeing a renaissance, if you will, a new renaissance of those techniques, that awareness, emerging in our age, and we're adding our own kind of special spin to it, our special awareness, our special expression to it in the present.
Mm-hmm. I know we're probably jumping ahead a little bit, and I apologize for that, but I know some of the listeners don't really know what yugas are and the different yugas. So maybe we can go through them and talk about the different yugas and what they represent.
Sure. So as I'd said just briefly, it's a 24,000-year cycle. And it's a cycle that has a similarity to the waxing and waning of the moon. Yeah, that's one of the best ways to describe it. So full moon is when man's highest potential is fully expressed. And then gradually over a period of 12,000 years, that wanes through these four distinct periods or ages until it reaches the nadir, when the least amount of man's potential is expressed. And then it begins again, and we begin to wax towards that full moon again. So in that 12,000-year descending arc, as we call it, and the complementary 12,000-year ascending arc, we go through four distinct stages. And in the terminology of India and the yugas, they are Satya Yuga, the highest, Treta Yuga, Dwapara Yuga, which I'd mentioned is the age we're in now, and then finally Kali Yuga. These correspond to what the Greeks called the Golden Age, Silver Age, the Bronze Age, and the Iron Age. And we also see this in other ancient cultures. This concept that there were higher ages in the past is pervasive in all ancient cultures. There's a...
Now, are these... Are they tied into, like, the precession of the equinox, or is there some other astronomical function that ties it into these ages?
They definitely are tied into the precession cycle, or sometimes referred to as the great year. And the current scientific belief, the astronomical, mainstream astronomical belief, is that the precessional cycle is about 25,800 years. Sri Yukteswar said the cycle was about 24,000 years. There's some speculation that the rate of precession actually speeds up and slows down due to astronomical conditions. But we're talking about the same general cycle, whether from the point of view of modern science or the point of view of the ancient wisdom of India. It is this precessional cycle. And it's in that period that we see this rising and then falling of man's consciousness. So you had asked about what were the qualities of the ages, and
yes,
from the lowest to the highest, the consciousness that we just saw the world go through for 2,000 years was material primarily, If you look, the man's general level of awareness was just of material things. It was a time that people were little better than property. The awareness that was used to move things along was a very mechanical kind of energy very simple, straightforward kind of uses of energy like water wheels and wind turbines and that sort of thing. And things were very formulaic. Religion was very fixed and dogmatic. Society was very fixed and dogmatic. You pretty much stayed in the circumstances you were born in for your entire life. There was very little flexibility. It was a fixed time. Mm-hmm. And according to Sri Yukteswar, that lasted from about 700 BC to 1700 AD, 2400 years. That was our nadir. That was our low point. That was when human sacrifice was practiced in the world, and when we had the gladiatorial games in Rome, where Emperor Trajan in one day's spectacle for the citizens of Rome, 10,000 people were killed. Just inconceivable to us today, the level of brutality and the reality that life was just cheap. There was no such thing as kind of inherent human rights. So Kali Yuga was not a time that I would have chosen to be around. Nor would I imagine most people would. So then we've moved into the energy age here, the Dwapara age, in 1700 AD, and I spoke a little bit about that awareness of both the inner and outer energy that underpins matter. Eventually we'll move into the third age, Treta Yuga, which is more of a mental age. One way I like to think of what the cycle of the yugas are doing is that they're peeling away the layers of ignorance that we have about who and what we really are. So in Kali Yuga, you're just body conscious. The average man is only aware of their lives, only aware of others through the senses, and through their awareness of their bodies. But when we get into Dwapara, that layer gets kind of peeled away to some extent. Each one of us has to do our own work to achieve these levels of awareness. But the awareness becomes possible, and more people have that awareness, and it becomes easier and easier for others to understand it. So when we reach Dwapara Yuga in 1700 AD, this first layer of material consciousness gets peeled away, and we begin to know and feel and be aware that we have these subtle bodies, that we can feel life force flowing through us. And that general awareness didn't exist in Kali Yuga except for the very rare few who could rise above that yuga, the adepts, the yogis from the ancient past, but the average person couldn't feel that. So when we see mankind move forward into the third age, Treta Yuga, according to Sri Yukteswar, we will see yet another layer kind of stripped away, and mankind as a whole will become more aware of thought and the power of thought. And that, as we're learning today, that energy is the underpinning of all matter, in Treta Yuga, in the third yuga, mankind will understand that thought is the underpinning of energy, more subtle and more powerful. Mm-hmm. And then finally, in the highest age, that layer will be stripped away, and mankind will realize that spirit, pure consciousness, underlies thought, and will have, again, a more direct relationship to that experience than they would even in Treta Yuga, which is itself a very high age. Now, all these are potentials we have. Any person in any age can tap into those. They are inherent to us. We are that. But we tend to, you know, identify with certain levels of our own being in these ages. But we're not locked into it, and we're not. It's not as if when we get into a higher age, we suddenly become something we aren't. We just become more aware of the greatness of who we are increasingly as we go through the ages.
Yeah, I noticed that a lot of people are struggling right now with, as you're saying, kind of phasing out of a real material existence and, you know, outer appearances and establishing self-worth through, you know, your car, your house, your, you know, your clothes, whatever, you know. But I've noticed that there's some people just recently are really having trouble making this transition into, you know, more focusing on the inner work or the spirit nature or things of that nature. And they're it just seems real recently it's really come up for a lot of people where they're in between worlds, you might say.
Well, I think we've seen an unprecedented, certainly in America and the West in general, we've seen a huge surge of material prosperity, and it really was easy, if you will, and there was a tide that we were all rising with together into prosperity, and as the old song goes, you know, the living was easy. And I think when we hit times when, like we have been, where the economy is difficult, people are worried about their jobs and worried about their futures and taking care of their children and all the things that we have as responsibilities, then you begin to, you know, you wrestle with this issue. Am I happy because I have things, or am I a happy person? How do I find that happiness? How do I really, what's the best way to live? What's the best way to use my consciousness to remain positive, to keep growing, to keep expanding as an individual when the material world is uncertain? And in many ways, I think it's a very good thing. I never wish it on anybody, but material adversity is often a very good teacher. A quote I like to say is that I think people are being given the opportunity to learn the difference between what it is. I'm approaching this quote the wrong way. The quote is, you have to realize that it's not the thing that you want, it's the feeling that you have when you get that thing that you want, and to learn to separate the feeling from the material object, and to realize that it's your own being's reaction to getting that thing that has made you happy, but it's your own being that has made you happy, not the thing. It's your reaction to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're like touchstones. I know they're a lot, you know, I've seen that before where somebody will get a new car and they're just really happy and they've actually attached their image to it and self-worth and everything else. And then somebody comes by and smashes it, or they get a big ding in it or whatever. And then, you know, their self-worth takes a big hit. You know?
Yeah. It's almost like they're physically injured when their car is physically hurt.
Yeah, and they don't realize they could have just been happy no matter what. You know, the car was just the touchstone, but they can just be happy for no reason whatsoever.
Yeah, I have a great story from the founder of the Ananda communities where I have been living for the last 35 years. Swami Kriyananda was going up to ski. We live not too far from ski areas where I am here. in the foothills of Northern California. And on the way, the car he was in ran into a bus and got damaged, and it was terrible conditions. It was snowy and icy, and they ran into a bus. So they just pulled the car over to the side of the road and got on the bus to continue on up to the ski area. And this one woman on the bus was, you know, consoling them, and she said, "Oh, you know, it's so terrible. I'm so sorry that this happened." And Kriyananda said, "You know, I'd be over this in a week, right? Why waste a week?"
Realize
that these are passing states, you know, that are really uh-huh. have nothing to do, shouldn't have anything to do with your essential consciousness.
Mm-hmm. I guess it's really tough for some people because they have, you know, a very strong attachment, and let's say they've been brought up in a material world, and most people around a TV set that's told them they've got to have this and they've got to have that, they've got to have the fancy car and drink the right beer and to get the chick in the bikini, you know, that whole program, you know, a lot of people have been raised with that all their life, and it's hard to break that pattern.
Yeah, we are well conditioned. I think what helps people break it is to have experiences that are beyond the material. You know, mm-hmm. maybe it's a moment of inspiration on a backpacking trip, or it's a glorious sunset, or it's a quiet moment of meditation, or it's a feeling of contentment and physical vitality doing Tai Chi, or any number of different ways that people experience this. And in those moments, you realize, even if you don't, you know, consciously tell yourself at the time, but in that moment you realize that those states of happiness are independent of the material world. And the more of those you can have, that's sort of the fundamental reason why people are encouraged to meditate and to go within, to seek experience within their own hearts and spines, is because you then uncondition yourself. You know, all those decades, as you say, of watching the beer commercials and being conditioned that material happiness is the way to go, you have to counteract it with real experience. It can't just be mental. It can't just be an mm-hmm. idea. You have to really feel it in your own heart that you are genuinely happy, and in the end, I think, more deeply happy and content by those inner experiences than you can ever be through sort of the counterfeit happiness of material possession.
Yeah, definitely. It seems like we are hitting the apex of material greed, you might say, and, you know, with the banksters and that program and where they're going. They made money real cheap and kind of doled it out to anybody and everybody and went with the derivatives and all the other things and so now, you know, we've had this kind of heyday and it's been allowed and now it seems to be, you know, reaching its apex and actually on its downward spiral. And what would you suggest to people that were caught up in that whole program?
Well, you know, turn within. There's so many different ways to turn within. Go with the one that draws you. For some people it is meditation. Others feel meditation is too austere for them. And dive into Tai Chi or mm-hmm. Hatha Yoga or just do things that give you that direct experience of your own inner self and the joy that comes with it, because ultimately everything comes from within. We just mm-hmm. think it's coming from material objects because there's this another way somebody put it once is having a desire for something is like pinching your finger. And then when you get it, you let go of the pinch and it feels so good, right? But we're pinching it because we're pinching our own happiness because we're saying, oh, I won't be happy until I have X, Y, or Z. And then when we get it, we release our own happiness. But we're always just experiencing ourselves. There is nothing else to experience.
Yeah, I've always felt it's really a good thing in a way that some of these people are losing everything, because I know a lot of them are actually, you know, going back and connecting with communities and family and getting their hands dirty again and getting and simplifying and growing gardens and doing a lot of things of that nature. And all of a sudden they're finding out that they're really happy, even though they almost lost everything. You know, they're having these big infusions of joy or spirit or love or bliss and you know, remembering or awakening to the fact that they bought into that whole other program and had no idea how unhappy they were.
Yeah. I think it's ironic that a lot of people's concept of what they need to do on their vacation is, quote unquote, get away from it all. Mm-hmm. They, you know, to get to where you can just be quiet and you're not constantly bombarded by television or radio or the internet, and be calm, enjoy nature, get some exercise, and then you feel better, and then you go back to your overly busy life, perhaps, and it starts to erode that away by just distracting you with all these worries and cares. But I think we all, on a very important and very deep level, realize that our happiness is something that comes from inside ourselves, and nothing else but our own consciousness can make us happy.
Yeah, I agree. I threw my TV set out the window in probably the early 70s. And every once in a while, I'll be at a conference or whatever, and I'll pick up the, flip on the TV and go through all 70 channels. And I just go, oh my God, there's like nothing on here at all. And some of it, just, you watch your body react to it. You just go, oh God, this is crazy making. And actually people watch this stuff. And, every once in a while I'll put on maybe the Discovery Channel or something like that, and there's something that has some merit to it. But, about the only thing I can handle now are comedies and maybe sci-fi once in a while and nature films, and that's about it.
Yeah, and even those, you have to be careful how you get them, because you get bombarded with the ads every 5 minutes, it seems like.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I highly recommend to people to get rid of their television, because it's such a distraction, and it's a sort of a steady drip, drip, drip of worry and fear and doubt, really, that comes through certainly the news that is broadcast to people. Mm-hmm. People are in perpetual states of concern and fear, because that's the way the news industry has learned they can kind of hold people's attention, keep stories alive by catering to those. And you can get away from them and your life just gets better and nothing bad happens because you're not paying any attention to all those things.
Yeah, we live in a real small town out in the middle of nowhere, and most of the people here, they go up to the store, or they go to the little diner, the local diner, the gas station. Everybody just leaves their keys in the car and their purse on the seat, pretty much. And we just don't have any problems. We had one guy take a car for a joyride, some kid, but I think it was one of his parents' cars. But, that's to be expected. But, overall, it's a very pretty, a very good community that we live in. But if you watch TV and you base your reality on that, I mean, you would think that, hey, there's a murder right next door every 5 minutes, and there's people with towels on their heads coming to kill us, and on and on and on. There's nuclear missiles aimed at us, and somebody's trying to build a nuke, and your name's on it, and it's orange alert or
right,
you know,
right.
It's just amazing. You just go, oh my God, you know, it's like this is just like Crazyville that they broadcast on the TV.
Yeah, and it just keeps people so anxious.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a shame.
It's totally contrary to actually putting people in the frame of mind necessary to make their own personal spirit God connection and run from that source. It keeps you trapped into your pain body or your emotional body or the material world. And I always tell people, you know, you're not going to go anywhere if you're glued to the TV set most of the day and you know, out of fear, because you got to know when they're coming to get you, you know, if you don't turn on the news every morning.
Yeah, no, it's true. But I think this is a passing stage for mankind. I think as the age progresses, you know, a lot of people often ask, when I say things are getting better, that we're on the upswing, they say, well, how can you possibly say that? You know, we're on the, from their point of view and from what they've been conditioned to think, you know, that we're on the brink of nuclear annihilation, we're on the brink of our food being destroyed, we're on the brink of any number of potentially catastrophic things, and people's mm-hmm. behavior is going to the dogs, and so on, so on, and so on. And they have a hard time believing that we could possibly be improving. But I think that what we're seeing is mankind as a whole has been given new capabilities and this awareness of energy inwardly and outwardly is being used in very, by and large, not exclusively, but by and large, being used in very self-interested and therefore negative kind of ways, and that we're seeing a lot of tension in the world that is in part a result of this new awareness. But I think the best way I know to express it is that the world is going through a sort of teenage phase, that teenagers come into willpower and energy and want to express themselves, but they don't have, for the most part, much garnered wisdom or understanding. And mm-hmm. so they do a lot of things that, as an adult, you look on and you go, well, you know, they'll pass through that. They'll make it to the other side. It's just a learning experience. And I think the world is going through a learning experience. Now, like teenage learning experiences, they can be painful, they can be difficult. We see tensions around the world that could lead to wars and conflict mm-hmm. and inhumane treatment of other people. It's not, in terms of the broader cycle of the yugas, we're relatively low in the arc still. The mm-hmm. future is very bright, but we're just coming out of this material era that I was talking about, and we're kind of shaking it off. We're learning mm-hmm. what it is to have these new capabilities, but we haven't really learned them all together. So it's kind of a mixed time. The other thing I like to say to people that ask me about the future is that it's not guaranteed how the future will unfold. According to this concept of the yugas, we will grow in this awareness and we will eventually reach these higher ages as a race, as humanity as a whole. But where we are right now, we can all, each individually, be agents for helping it unfold as quickly as possible. And that the more people who live inward lives or have a sense of inner self and live from it, we can be powerful agents of change. We can channel this, the positive side of energy awareness into society very, very effectively. We don't have to be passive and wait for the unfolding of the age.
Yeah, I agree 100%. It's I always tell people if we could just, you know, gather together and in agreement collectively and just agree on the basic universal principles that are necessary for a healthy society and environment. And, you know, we don't have to attach a religion to it or an image or a name or anything else. Just agree about the basics or just focus on love and joy and bliss as a collective. We can really turn this planet around and, you know, just with a little right thinking and right action.
Yeah. Yeah. And positive energy, many studies have shown that deliberate positive energy is much more powerful than non-deliberate, sort of unconscious negative energy. In other words, the sort of herd mentality of material consciousness and conflict is huge and seemingly unstoppable, I think, at times. But it isn't that deliberate. People have just sort of bought into it and are coasting along with it, where deliberate positivity can really bring about much greater change than people often think. Mm-hmm. Like it's like being a beacon of light. If you could see the astral light, you know, if you could see the subtle light emanating from people who are positive, you would see that it just blankets and affects everybody around them, where the darker, less energetic, more passive energy of material consciousness is there, but nowhere near as potent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know the TM movement had some kind of a formula. I can't remember what it was, but it was amazing how many people it took, a small amount of people that were really hooked into the higher consciousness and energy could actually change an entire, you know, city or even a state, you know, or even, I guess, planetary. You could actually measure changes when you had enough people working on that. And I found out that there are some people that are, you know, they're plugged into the source itself. You know, they go all the way through the vibration continuum to their own God self and then focus that energy into the mix, and you know, they create huge waves, that impacts the negativity.
I think the TM folks did some actual sort of quantitative experimentation with that, of what percentage of a population praying for a certain outcome would be required to actually bring it about, and they did certain things in certain cities for X amount of time, and I think they found it something like a tenth of a percent of the population praying for a specific outcome could make it happen. They lowered crime rates in cities and it basically had an effect just through that tiny portion of the population being focused on it. So we are... Mm-hmm. We're much more powerful than we tend to think.
Yeah. I know that, you know, we are kind of going through some chaos. And like you were saying, I just see it as a stew. You know, there's the fire's on and the stew's being cooked and all the garbage kind of rises to the top and you got to skim it off. And that's kind of is happening, you know, with all these events happening around the world. It's actually a good thing, because usually when you go from one age to another, there is a chaos phase before you get back into, you know, with I'm trying to think of the Symantics. I think it has a really good process on that, but where they turn the frequency up and everything goes into chaos, and then all of a sudden it takes a new form, a new higher order. So that's why I look at it, is that, you know, the chaos is a good thing, and it's just taking us to the next level.
Yeah, old forms can't handle the new energy. You know, the old materialistic forms of I think in some ways we're seeing the transformation of the concept of the nation state, you know, the fundamental political units around the world. We're seeing that in a period of transformation. You know, we're seeing large countries break up into small countries, and you know, there's a lot more power of the individual being expressed rather than the power of the states. And so, but we haven't made the transition. The nation state is still the law of the land, and the traditions and legal precedents that make them still viable are still in place, and gradually will change those. I think you see this taking place as a change in religion of many people. I'm sure you've heard this. Many more people consider themselves in America to be spiritual than religious. And even if they are affiliated with a particular religion, they still make a mental separation in their mind between those two, and that transformation is underway as well. We see the transformation, I think, with the way people are perceived, the kind of emergence of minority rights and a gradual group learning process to be tolerant and accepting of many, many, many different types of people. And even in the last 100 years, that has been a tremendous step forward. But it's still going. The old prejudices are still there. You see many countries kind of locked into battles, locked into hatred and conflict with other countries, like what we saw in Yugoslavia and former Yugoslavia when it broke up. The old hatreds that were just sort of buried and simmering just came to the surface. So we still see them, but I think they're transforming as this new energy comes in. And as you say, I think appropriately, it's creating this sort of stew of change, and depending on where you are in that stew, it might be confusing, might be outright difficult.
Mm-hmm. Did you see, I don't know if you probably caught that, it was going around on the internet, but where there's these people over in Israel, and they're making videos about saying, "Iran, we love you," and then Iran has come back and saying, "You know, we love you too. We don't want to go to war, and we don't know you, but, you know, we love you." And so all the people are starting to gather around these videos and wanting to come together in peace. And I think that's how it's going to have to happen, from the bottom up, you know, in a grassroots movement, and, you know, to put some pressures on the governments, because the governments are the ones that go to war. The people don't want to go to war. They don't want to have anything to do with war.
And not only do the people not want to go to war, the armies don't want to go to war. It's just the political people who are, you know, feel like they are designated, delegated to bring things to that kind of crisis that really do it. So. Yeah, I
say put them on the front line. That's my solution. Is if you vote for war, then you go to the front line.
Yeah, yeah. Yogananda said if they put all the people who ran the countries that went to war in a building and gave them all guns, they'd make peace in about 10 minutes.
Yeah. And unless there was some money involved, you know, then they'd probably fight over that for a little while and then divvy it up later.
But, you know, there are many things happening, and I was glad you brought up the story about the Israelis sending out peaceful intent to the Iranians and some Iranians sending out peaceful intent back, there's a quieter revolution happening, which I hinted at in the opening remarks about this being a kind of a new renaissance we're in right now.
Oh, yeah.
That doesn't get the press because it's not about fear or conflict or money or fame. The main sort of selling points of our popular media, it's really the quiet expression of a very pervasive worldwide movement toward this deeper understanding. And I refer to it as a new renaissance because in fact, this will be a theme, major theme of the conference that I'm MC at and will be presenting at in the spring, end of May, Memorial Day weekend. It's a conference on the yuga cycles and our current awakening consciousness. And the theme is this new renaissance. We have people who represent ancient knowledge, and we have people who represent cutting-edge new knowledge that are mirrors of each other. So, for example, we have Joan Borisenko, who is a pioneer of mind-body medicine. We have Amit Goswami, who's a pioneer of quantum physics and the subtle energies that are the underpinning of material creation. And then we also have speakers such as Robert Schock, who has dated the Sphinx to many thousands of years earlier than is commonly believed, and Christopher Dunn, who's looked into advanced stonemasonry in the Giza Plateau and in South America. We have Walter Cruttenden, who's and also a fellow author on the subject of the yugas with his book, The Lost Star. And what we can see is that in a time that is corresponds in the descending arc of the yugas, the past descending arc, corresponds with our current point in the ascending arc, that many of the things that we're discovering through science and medicine were old hats, so to speak, in that period of time in the past, such as yoga, meditation. Acupuncture has been practiced since 3000 BC. There are ivory acupuncture needles in the museum in Beijing that date to 3000 BC.
I know that that a lot of the Nobel Prize winners, actually, every time I turn around and hear about somebody who won a Nobel Prize, he usually got it out of the ancient Vedic teachings, or, you know, one guy got a Nobel Prize by realizing that, you know, bacteria was more prolific around the full moon or whatever. So, that's Vedic medicine, but...
Right. Yeah, you find it in Vedic medicine, you find it in Egyptian medicine, traditional Chinese medicine. And a lot of the difficulty with these kind of renaissance, like the reason why I'm calling it the new renaissance is because the European renaissance, which took place in the 13, 14, 1500s, was inspired by ancient Greek philosophy and science. And that ancient Greek philosophy and science came from an era that, if you, again, could see the descending arc of the yugas and place the Greeks on it, and then see the ascending arc of the yugas and place the Renaissance on it, you would see that they corresponded to the same point in their respective ages. And so we're seeing that repeated, where the European scientists like Descartes and Copernicus and others were inspired by Plato and Aristotle and Aristarchus. We're now seeing that the pioneers today, like Amit Goswami and Joan Borisenko are inspired by the teachers like Krishna and Lao Tzu and the life force techniques that were commonplace around the time when those great teachers were alive. So we're seeing the awakening to that same consciousness. So when we look back with fascination at these ancient teachings and the higher knowledge that they have, the reason why we're looking back and sort of latching on to certain ones is because they resonate with today. And that's going to be the theme of the conference, is exploring the past, showing how it's informing the present, and then how the present is discovering independently the same principles. Like, for example, Tai Chi. Tai Chi is a new form of life force life force, the use of life force, the tuning into and moving life force through your body for health. It's new. But it arose because we now have a greater awareness of life force, and it was put to use in a unique way. But you can see a lot of similarities between it and yoga, mm-hmm. which is ancient. Similarly with what we think of as mind-body medicine. You know, we're discovering on a quote-unquote scientific level with people like Joan Borisenko, Bernie Siegel, Deepak Chopra are telling us that what medicine is discovering is that the mind heals the body. Or, contrary, unfortunately, the mind can keep the body unwell. And that if we can treat the mind, we can heal the body. Well, that's the core of Ayurveda, ancient Egyptian medicine, ancient Chinese medicine, is this mind-body connection as well. So it's fascinating to see that, for me, the corroboration, that the clear evidence, the footprint of this cycle mm-hmm. of the yugas, that it's not just a kind of a fanciful notion that has really no bearing on anything today. But you really do see that the past is informing the present, that mm-hmm. whether we believed in the yuga cycle or not, mankind as a whole is drawing from a reservoir of ancient wisdom that resonates with our understanding of things today.
Mm-hmm. Well, that conference sounds like a wonderful conference. How would people go about checking into that and getting the details on when and where and how to contact?
Well, we have a website just called theyugasconference.com, and that will take you in to an area of the Expanding Light website. The Expanding Light is the venue. They are hosting the conference. And you can learn about all the speakers who are going to be there, their bios and their talks, accommodations, et cetera. So it's just theyugasconference.com.
Mm-hmm. And when is this conference going to be held?
It's Memorial Day weekend. It's May 25th through the 28th.
And where?
It's near Nevada City, California, which is in the sort of Sacramento region, mm-hmm. up in the foothills outside of Sacramento. It's really a beautiful facility. It's the area here where I live. We're up in the foothills about 2,500 feet, and in spring it is just glorious to be here. And it's in a venue. The Expanding Light is dedicated to sharing basically subtle energy teachings in the form of yoga, meditation, and many other things. So it's not only a nice place to be, but the vibration is really congruent with what we're going to be talking about.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it sounds wonderful. I might be able to get off the ranch here and go check some of these out.
I'd love to have you come.
They sound They sound really good. The I tell you what's interesting here. We do process oriented therapy here, and a lot of different processes of Qigong and some yoga. Not as much as I took yoga 10 years, but I'm not in any shape to do it now like I used to do it. That's for sure, and I need to get back into it. But one of the things that we notice in doing counseling is that there are so many people coming in now and that are here now that actually were, they came in during the 16th century, the new Renaissance, and now they've returned again for the next new Renaissance. And we keep coming up with that over and over and over again, you know, when we're doing counseling work or clearing work, is that there are so many people that actually had past lives in the 16th century.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, they do say, I've read various books that indicate that souls tend to incarnate as sort of big extended families.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's sort of a general purpose to their incarnation. And
it's like a wave.
Yeah, it's like a wave. And so the wave that was trying to pioneer new consciousness in the European Renaissance may well have come into incarnation now to pioneer a new expression based on this new energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're getting a lot of combinations of like ancient Lemurian or Atlantis, you know, consciousness, as well as the 16th century. Mostly Lemurian and 16th century seem to come up together over and over again. You know, it's amazing. And I think about the Lemurian consciousness where, you know, everybody was one big family. They were very close to nature, very spirit oriented. And you know, they more worshiped the unseen God, you know, the creator in all things. You know, they didn't have an image of a little old man with a beard and a book, you know, taking notes.
Anthropomorphic God.
Yeah, and that seems to be coming back on you know, just an amazing numbers that we keep coming up with over and over again.
Yeah, now that actually doesn't surprise me. I think what we're seeing in the evolutionary unfolding of how people seek spirit is that the older model of a, as you say, you know, a man with a gray beard in an antiseptic corner of the universe, creating us and creating our worlds and then sort of watching from afar, you know, with a judgmental sense. I think that model is no longer credible to increasing numbers of people, mm-hmm. but rather than turning to disbelief altogether, which some people are, obviously atheism is a major trend today, but I think many people want there to be something they can embrace because they know intuitively, they know from within that there is something more than this material world, that their emotions are not simply the result of chemical interactions in their brain, that what they feel is something bigger than themselves, and that their consciousness is greater than their brain. They just know it, they feel it, but it's kind of an inchoate knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And they're frustrated by the fact that they can't embrace the dominant sort of religious forms of the day. I know many of my friends who subsequently learned to meditate and to do more inward practices were raised as Catholics or who were devout in other faiths. And they really yearned for it. But when, you know, the story gets told over and over and over again, when they reached their teens and 20s, they just couldn't stay with it because the dogma, the model they were being told was the truth. They couldn't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
And So more and more people, I think, are turning to these ancient forms or ancient practices, because they're not really forms, but they're ancient practices to give you your own, to give you control of your own spiritual quest, that it becomes experiential and it becomes individual, and that you're not reliant on a priest or somebody outside you to anoint you and tell you what to do, that you are on your own spiritual journey. And that wave of empowerment, I think, is tremendously transformative in the world today.
You know, I agree. I know that I was on a show just a couple of days ago, and the question was posed to me, you know, how do you know this just isn't some kind of chemical reaction or a trigger, oxygen deprivation or something that actually would trigger you to have these higher dimensional experiences?
And what did you answer?
something to get your, well, basically I told him, I said, well, you know, I said, some of the things I experienced, there's no way I could have dreamed those up. And I said, also too, because we're in a vortex here, the veils are very thin. There's major ley lines coming through this property here, and it's a really interesting place. And we've actually had masters appear here and photograph them. We've had Buddhist monks actually photograph different masters that I've been working with for quite some time. And the photographs were very accurate, you know, as far as how they appeared to me. So I said, you know, the camera really doesn't need oxygen. You know, it doesn't have a mind, so to speak. It's not going to, it doesn't have a belief system. You know, it's just technology. And so, and, you know, a good example, we were doing a self-mastery class and Mary actually appeared in the middle of the room. And I'm saying, I'm not Catholic. She's a universal being, but she actually appeared in the room and everybody just were getting this incredible feelings of love and joy and bliss and healing. And it was just phenomenal. And one of the monks grabbed his camera and took a picture and got a beautiful picture of Mary appearing over the class. So, you know, I say, well, you know, we felt her, we sensed her, we knew she was there. You know, all the inner senses were going off like crazy. People were having healings and you know, major openings and initiations. And then the camera took the picture. So putting all that together, I would have to say that there's so much more than just a chemical reaction or some oxygen deprivation thing that they're trying to explain this away with.
Yeah, and I think that's the shared experience of people who are open enough to try to have these kind of experiences, or at least venture forward with the notion that there might, that kind of experience might be possible, and then. Mm-hmm. And then when they have them, there's just no doubt. But the doubters, those who've never had these kind of experiences and who are wedded to a materialistic view of things, you know, are the ones who say, "Well, this is just all some chemical transformation that's happening in your brain." And I think that's why we get visitations like you did, and that's why. Spiritual masters will perform miracles. Jesus said that he performed miracles, that lest people see signs and wonders, they shall not believe, that people need to be sort of jolted out of their convictions of the world only being material. And so you have the miracles of teachers like Sai Baba and others that just confound this notion that it's all in your mind, because they objectify the reality of spirit within. Mm-hmm. But it's hard for people. You know, people are just they find it in our the modern day story of science is very powerful. And it's hard for people to imagine that there could possibly be another reality, subtler reality, that that science hasn't found.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have some toys here where we have third generation night vision goggles and infrared spotlights, and we can light up the next dimension so people can see it. it really shocks people when it happens, and all of a sudden they go, "Oh my God!" And they see, you know, the plasma fields, they see the light spheres flying around and interacting with people, and all kinds of things. I had a scientist here that, and she was just putting all this down and saying, you know, you talk about this vibrational continuum or these other planes and dimensions and everything else. And she goes, how do you know they exist? And she was just like really throwing it out there and getting hung up on semantics and, you know, trying to talk in, we have different languages or different words for certain things, and it was quite interesting. And finally I said, well, just come out to the field tonight. I put the goggles on her and lit up the infrared vision, and it just blew her mind. And she goes, what is that? She goes, I can't believe this. What is this? She goes, I didn't know that was there and everything else. She goes, what is it? And I said, I don't know, you define it. You know. I just left it with her to define, you know, in
right,
her way.
Right. But it's an experience that she will unlikely ever be able to, you know, forget or explain away. And that's what the experiential practices are really all about. They're mm-hmm. non-denominational. They're not sectarian. They work on the universal realities of the way we are made. You know, we all experience in similar fashions. We have the same equipment mm-hmm. to experience. And so yoga and tai chi and meditation use that universal similarity between all people to bestow that direct experience on people. And it's nothing to do with what you believe, but it's what you experience.
Mm-hmm. We have a room up here. It's a meditation room. We do a lot of counseling work in it and things, and we've just got phenomenal photographs of energies appearing there. There's a couple here on the ranch that hang out up there quite a bit, and you know, they do their practices and they're doing like tai chi and things like that, and they're photographing. They put the camera up and it took photographs as they're doing their practices, and all of a sudden you could see right through them. You could see the chairs behind them, you know, things of that nature. And then this guy from Germany came up and brought this technology. I think it's called PIP technology, where they can break down the light spectrum and see what's going on in the room and actually videotape it. And so he wanted to videotape one of the counseling sessions. And you could see when we started the session, this beautiful golden, like a tornado of energy, started coming into the room, and it was beautiful golden green energy. And all of a sudden it just went out from the center and touched everybody. And you could see everybody's fields change and their bodies. It was just amazing. I love seeing things like that, because I mean, I know it's going on. I feel it going on. And sometimes I actually see it, but to have technology now that can actually document this is just amazing.
And I think that it's a great story, because it allows me to say that Sri Yukteswar and Yogananda basically are predicting that that kind of awareness will become the shared awareness in the future, that we're needing to have these technological aids now, but that in future that will be the norm, that people will mm-hmm. actually see each other's energetic auras and be aware of their own and see how they intermingle. And that really is the heart of the energy age, not nuclear energy or the knowledge of quantum physics or string theory. Those are the external indicators that we've come into this age, but the real change is our direct perception of energy. I think if you could put yourself in a time machine and go 2,000 years into the future towards the end of our energy age, that you'd be more surprised by what people were like than you would be by what technology had become.
Mm-hmm.
That we will outstrip by far any technological advances that may have been made between now and then. And even those, I think, are going to be spectacular. Mm-hmm. Yogananda hinted, Sri Yukteswar hinted that during this period, mankind would, as he put it, overcome the limitations of space. And so you can see easily the extrapolation of that to space travel, to maybe teleportation, that we are, on a scientific level, on an outward level, we are delving into the very structure of the physical universe and are discovering more and more that we can manipulate it, we can move through it by our understanding of energy, and we're just getting started. You know, and you can mm-hmm. say we ain't seen nothing yet from technology.
Yeah.
But even saying that, I still say that if we could go 2,000 years in the future, you'd be more surprised by the commonplace perception of everyday people than you would be by the wonders of technology. And we are mm-hmm. just incredible beings, and we're just awakening more to that in this era.
Yeah, we have one of the master teachers, Khan, that comes here, and he's the one that photographed Mary. He actually sees these beings and then, you know, actually photographs me. He got a picture of Kuan Yin out in our field, and Kazekiel, one of the other beings I work with, and actually some feline beings as well, which is pretty interesting, that are about 12 feet tall. But it's quite interesting, some of the things that he's photographed. But this guy actually bilocates and dematerializes and rematerializes, and he'll be in Japan, and then next thing you know, he's in Korea digging himself out of the snow, right in front of one of these monasteries or whatever. It's quite interesting, but he's been bilocating quite a bit, doesn't really have control over it yet, but the first time he did it, he ended up just in jeans and a t-shirt and digging himself out of the snow and showing up, you know, at I guess it's a lamasery or some kind of temple. But he told them who he was, and they knew his master teacher, so they connected and got him back home. You know, they had some diplomatic connections and made it so he could get back home. But I think it's interesting. I think eventually that's just, you know, we're not going to need jets or buses or cars or things like that. We're just going to put our thought on where we want to be and just zip out from one spot and pop in on the other.
We are tremendously powerful, and we show that power every day without realizing that we're showing that power. One of my favorite illustrative stories about that is the condition that is known as multiple personalities.
Yes.
In the mid-60s, approximately, the condition first was identified, and there were, you know, of course, movies made, The Three Faces of Eve and Sybil, etc. But it also began a period of careful clinical study of the phenomenon. And mm-hmm. in addition, many people don't know this, but in addition to the profound personality changes that people would go through when they move from one personality to the other, they would also undergo physiological changes.
Mm-hmm.
Some personalities have moles that other personalities don't. Some personalities would be allergic to, say, bee stings. There's one story told of a personality that was stung by a bee, began to have the dangerous, potentially life-threatening reaction to it. On the way to the hospital, another personality emerged, and all traces of the reaction to the bee sting vanished instantaneously. If one personality takes a drug and another personality comes in, they're totally unaffected by the drug. Some personalities need to wear glasses. They literally can't see without their glasses. And some personalities have different eye color.
Mm-hmm.
And all these physiological changes happen instantaneously when the personality changes. And I think this is a really good way of illustrating how our own minds, bringing it down to a personal level, our own minds are at a deep level determining what we look like. And if we were to have alternate personalities, and that alternate personality had a different view of what we looked like, we would change as soon as we went into that alternate personality, because the mind's imprint, the mind's template of our body and physiology is really what causes us to be the way we are and to have the health we have, to have the conditions we have. So imagine a world in Treta Yuga, in this higher yuga, where people not only have the understanding of subtle energy that we're beginning to learn about today, but they have the understanding of thought as well, and could literally transform physically and transform physical objects through the power of their mind. We get some hint of this when we study the Vedas and the way in which the Vedas were used in the previous Treta Yuga era. The Vedas and chanting the Vedas were really a way of transforming the layers of reality into new forms, because they were being used by people who had these mental powers. And you could say that the Vedas were like a toolkit, a tech manual for how to use the mind to transform the world.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. I've always thought about that. I've had some experiences where I've actually bilocated and taken whole vehicles with me, and really well documented on both ends. But I think about that. Why can't I just raise my frequencies up, go into my etheric body or my whole and healthy, perfect imprint, and then come back and then drop all the other little ailments, you know, that are going on.
Uh-huh.
And I know it's possible. I definitely know it's possible. I have no doubt whatsoever that it can happen. But I just haven't gotten on top of that one. I don't know if you have any hints in that area.
Well, it's Kriyananda told a story that I always chuckle over, that someone was saying to him that they were having a problem dealing with some issue or another, and he said, you know, I know it's all in my mind. And Kriyananda said, yeah, that's the problem. that's not the easy part. The mind is much more powerful than the energetic body, and the energetic body is much more powerful than the physical body. So when you're dealing with the causal level of awareness, the mental level of awareness, you're getting down about as deep as you can get. And you know, the spiritual masters are masters because they can change their thoughts at will. That's why we call them masters, not because we are their slaves, but because they have mastered themselves on all levels, physical, energetic, mental, and spiritual levels. So I wish I had an easy answer for you. If I did, I would I would use it myself. But that's the work. That's why we're here.
Yeah.
Is to keep practicing and keep learning incrementally through experience.
Yeah, exactly. I know there's practices, and I know we have we do these walks here in the field. We have this beautiful field out in front of us, an echinacea field with a little trail around it, and I know, you know, you can focus on, like, I've always been whole and healthy, or I've always been, you know, 25 or whatever, you know, and you can create mantras and just hold that focus and reprogram your body and your consciousness. You know, it, when I stop doing that and I don't do my practices, I really feel it. You know, I can feel the difference. And sometimes we get, you know, we've been just buried under snow, and I usually do the practices out in nature. And so I haven't been doing the walks or doing the Yigong or the yoga or things like that. But I know I just have to make a real nice space inside to do that, and which is one of the things we're working on right now.
Yeah, Yogananda said if you could affirm anything with the same level of conviction that you believe its opposite, that you can change it in an instant.
Uh-huh.
But we believe on many levels, right? And they're not all, in fact, most are not at a conscious level. So we have to believe it to a depth that overcomes all of our subconscious and conscious conditioning is telling us that it's true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can tell ourselves that we're not a body, but when we run into the wall, it hurts, right?
And
it's not a surprise to us that it hurts. We expected it to hurt. And so that tells us that we deeply believe in the reality of that body.
Mm-hmm.
So it's no small thing to overcome that conditioning.
I've always heard, and I've had this theory about that, but my theory on ascension is to bring spirit fully into the body, and it creates a quickening, you know, bring it into the very cell itself, and then the body starts raising in frequency and eventually ascends. And then there's another theory that where people just deny the physical and say this body's dust, and you know, the material world is all Maya. You know, unfortunately, they always seem to die. You know, and I've always wondered about that. By actually saying the body is dust, or focusing on the body is dust and unimportant or whatever, that seems to, it would actually create that reality. The body will turn to dust, and if it isn't a priority and we don't take care of it, then, you know, we do end up, you know, crossing over maybe at an earlier age.
Right. I was being a little loose. I agree with you, and I was being a little loose in my example there of affirming that you aren't the body. I meant it more in terms of actually affirming that you are the spirit, and that the body is just a garment, and that you get more in touch with the spirit, as you say, as you raise in frequency and raise in consciousness. So I think we're saying the same thing. I was just a little flip with my example.
It was just something I've seen over and over. I always wonder, you know, how some, you know, there's like, you know, Baba G ascended, you know, took the body with him in a big flash of light, and others seem to have crossed over, but they also ascended maybe later, went through several processes afterwards. But, you know, I've always thought about that. That's something that's always piqued my mind is that maybe there's a little glitch in the program that we need to look at if we're actually going to fully ascend and take the body with us.
Or we take the higher body with us. Yogananda said that in the Satya Yuga, the highest age that people would be able, common, it would be commonplace for people to, as he put it, see into the astral, that the boundary between material creation and the energy realm of the astral would be, you know, very, very thin, that you would actually be able to see into that world. And I think that, as I understand it, that you would be doing that because you would mostly be identified with your astral body, or more identified with your astral body than with your physical, and that when you do that, it brings with it that perception that is resonant with what you're identifying with, which is you can see the astral. So I would say we bring spirit in, not so much to rid ourselves of the body, but to overcome our focus on the body, our one-pointed conviction that the body is who and what we are. And
it seems the pendulum has swung so far into the body and material, you know, materiality and outer appearances, things like that. It probably wouldn't be a bad idea to swing it the other way until we find balance. You know.
Yeah, and the way Yogananda describes it is that we are all of those at once. We're wearing a physical body, an energy body, a causal body, surrounding the essential spirit nature of ourselves, and we have them all simultaneously. But we're identifying more with the physical in general in our time, in our age, than we are with the astral, and therefore as a general rule in our society, more people are aware of and comfortable with the notion of the physical world, and only a handful of people are aware of and comfortable with the subtler astral.
It's like 30 years ago, I think it was, I had a drowning, like a near-death experience, and I went through the tunnel and ended up in that golden plane of bliss. It was the most incredible thing. But when I came back, I could see things shifting from a material object to these little just energy. It was going back and forth, and I had a lot of trouble grounding again and getting back, getting my feet on the ground. And what really blew me away is even trash. You know, I used to walk down the beach and I'd see trash on the beach and I'd get all pissed off, you know, and say, I can't believe, you know, people just leave their trash here. You know, what's wrong with them? And, you know, and go pick it up or whatever. But it was so interesting when I was all of a sudden looking at the trash and it started like shifting from a physical object to, you know, all this little energy, like little golden energy patterns and light patterns. And you know, it just totally blew my mind. It actually kind of blew me right out of judgment, you know, and I said, well, everything's just energy, basically condensed energy. And you know, it changed my whole mindset on that.
Yeah. Deep blessing, it sounds like.
Yeah, but I still think it's pretty unconscious to leave all your trash at the beach. but anyway, I don't get all upset over it. You know, I just say, well, it's just, you know, people doing their thing. They're just not real conscious yet of you know, picking up after themselves, you might say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like a remarkable experience. I've long been a student of near-death experiences, and one of my all-time favorite videos is the Life After Life video that has Danny and Brinkley and others in it. And like you, you know, they just were transformed because they experienced it directly. Just there's no more doubt. It's not intellectual. It's not a mental concept. It just is, and it's very powerful.
Yeah, it's. I've had people, you know, try to get me to convince them, you know, of what's happening on the other side, you know, and things like that. And I just said, you know, that's not my job. I have no doubt whatsoever, but I said I can help you and give you some tools and techniques and to have your own experience. But, you know, how do you prove something to somebody that has no reference whatsoever? It's you really can. It's an individual journey, and people need to do it themselves.
Well, it sounds like a good work that you're doing there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The are you still at Ananda?
Yeah, I live in Ananda Village. Ananda has a number of communities around the world, and we have one here. This is the starting community. I moved here about 35 years ago, a little over that, when it was in its infancy. Had the pleasure of being part of the kind of founding family of people who helped make it happen. Since then, we have grown considerably to other locations. We have a community in your area, in Portland, a community in Seattle, in the Bay Area, in L.A., and then also in India and in Italy. And the kind of uniting theme of them all is that we found from our own community experience here of creating the community that there's a real power to mixing with people who all have the same goal, and that by, you know, being together, and here there's a couple hundred people and other communities are smaller than that, but that it really intensifies your own spiritual quest. And so we have found it just an amazing lifestyle to share with people wherever we can around the world.
Now that your lifestyle there, does it, I'm sure you have you probably do Kriya Yoga and the meditation practices and do you have that like on a regular, let's say daily morning event or evening event or noon event or something like that?
Well, we're all encouraged to practice Kriya Yoga. That is the great prize that Yogananda brought with him to America. It's a pranayama technique that is very effective for stilling the body, stilling the mind, and just helping you get into that deep stillness in which you experience that response, that divine response of spirit. And so as individuals, we are encouraged to practice that twice a day. And then to help us do that, but not a requirement, there are group meditations that you can go to if you want to take advantage of the energy that a group can add to your own meditation practice. But it's more an inward personal practice. And then the community strengthens it by, group meditation, events that we have, kirtans where we chant. That's a strong tradition that Yogananda brought from India of chanting, because chanting gets you out of your mind and into your heart. And as I'm sure you probably know, most people, when you try to meditate, one of the big challenges is that you just keep thinking, right? You keep on thinking about what you were doing that day and so forth. And chanting is a very effective, pragmatic way of moving you out of that mindfulness or mindlessness, depending on how you want to think of it, and putting you into your heart and focusing you on what you're actually doing. So we have a lot of emphasis on chanting. And then because we are all together, there's a lot of opportunities for service, a lot of work days. We have businesses here that we own as a community. I would say about half and half, half the people who live here work in a community business like our market or our ministry or our publishing company or our retreat, the Expanding Light Retreat, where the conference is being held. And then the other half, such as myself, we have our own businesses or work outside the community that allows us to live here, but work in another way. I do web development projects to earn a living and have a little business to that effect. And there are others like me who have other professions that aren't part of the community. But we all share in the benefits and the service that the community offers to us. It's a great way to live. It's hard for me to imagine not being surrounded by people who share convictions and share practices. And of course, I have years of friendship with very dear people from having been here for 35 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've always felt it is so important to have a practice. You know, I usually do a morning and then an evening practice of meditation, and sometimes I'll do Yigong or some other practices. But you know, without that, I think it's very hard to keep it together and even keep a community together, because you just have a lot of egos running amok, without any real shared purpose or unity. You know, there's no real unity consciousness going on there. So I think it is real important to have maybe a time and communal time where everybody works together and focuses on, you know, creating a different future or moving things forward.
Yeah, no, it's a good point, because I think that if you have a community, I having lived in a community, I've studied the community's movement, sort of the broader concept of communities all over America and the world, and a large percentage of them are what you would call spiritual communities, that there's some tie that puts them together, draws them together, and gives them a kind of a direction and goal and a purpose. But of the communities that are not sort of spiritually focused, what I have noticed is that they are more social experiments, and there's a lot of processing that takes place
yeah.
that isn't actually necessary or as necessary in spiritually oriented communities, precisely because of what you said, that the going within and finding your own inner contentment and compassion and love is the lubrication that allows people to live in such close awareness of each other. We're not necessarily in close proximity. I live in a what would be anybody would think of as a typical single family home, as do most of the people who live in the community here. So we don't live communally in the classic sense of all sharing one big building or something. But we're in close awareness of each other, because we work on projects together and we do things together. And I think without that lubrication of spiritual peace, it would be much harder to do. And I'm not sure you would really, frankly, get that much out of it. You know, yeah, you might find yourself thinking, well, I'll just go live in suburbia if it's going to be this hard. But when you have that, when you have that shared spiritual vibration, then you really understand the benefit.
Yeah, I've seen that. It's like you're talking about the social experiments. You know, as soon as you get away from the spiritual practices, it does turn into a social experiment, and then, you know, unfortunately, you know, when you have, let's say, 10 egos, they all have a different drive, a different idea or different needs or want to see things go in a different direction. And without some kind of unity consciousness going on there, it's a madhouse.
Yeah. But, you know, we're all drawn to what's going to be a positive for us, I believe. And that may be the kind of growth that folks need. Mm-hmm. But it's a very rich life here. It's been a a given for me for so long that when I'm traveling on business or with other people who don't live this way and I start to describe it to them, I'm always struck by how foreign it seems to them when it seems so commonsensically positive to me that I would think they'd go, oh, yeah, that sounds great. I'd love to do that. But that will come. That will come.
Yeah,
I think part of the unfolding of the age is more and more people will want to have quality of life rather than quantity of life. Mm-hmm. Quality of life is going to be about being with like-minded people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the I've noticed. I'm just curious if you noticed that some people are actually threatened by the life that you live. If they have a, let's say a real, you know, they're really embedded, you know, into material life or material existence or the status quo or social consciousness, whatever you want to call it. Sometimes, you know, you'll talk to them about things and they actually become threatened by it.
I think I have noticed that in some instances, but it's rare, extremely rare.
Yeah.
More what I've discovered when I'm sharing it with people who, you know, have no connection to me whatsoever, and they politely ask me what I do, and I tell them, I'm always a little bit surprised that they just go sort of, oh, that's nice, and then they don't ask anything more. I'm always curious. I'm always curious. When I'm with somebody who knows something or does something that I don't know about already, I just ask them a million questions. I want to know all the ins and outs of it. And so I'm always a little bit astonished by people who are disinterested in something that, from their point of view, I'm sure is extremely unique or unusual, not unique, but extremely unusual. So Yogananda said that the malaise, the spiritual malaise, the spiritual illness of our age is indifference to spirit. Mm-hmm. That we're, as a society, we've become so preoccupied with the material and prosperity and success and working that the majority of people are just simply indifferent rather than strictly non-believers. They're just indifferent.
Mm-hmm. I love what he said once. He was talking about, you know, your biological family, and he says, you know, if your brother's a thief, you know, you have to love him and accept him, but you really want to hang out with your spiritual family. You know? And so I've seen that over and over again, where people of like mind are gathering and coming together and, you know, creating more of a spiritual family and kind of stepping out of the old program, you know, the status quo.
Yeah. No, things are changing. I think there's much more positive change than we know because of the dominance of the mainstream media's interest in the negative sides of the world, that if you seek it and you really look for the good news and really look for an awareness of the thousands of places like your community and Ananda community and many, many others where people are living very different lifestyles and than the mainstream, I think people would be surprised how widespread it actually is. There's a lot more than most people know.
Oh, yeah, I agree. I know they always say, you know, the lie travels twice around the world before the truth has time to tie its shoes. And you know, what's that old saying? It's pretty bad, but they say if it bleeds, it leads, you know, in the press. So then that's just the way the press is. But it'd be nice to, you know, have an alternative news source, which they seem to be coming forward now that are really focused on the positive things going on and all the, you know, the new natural healing technologies coming forward and herbs and things like that and free energy devices, things. It'd be nice to have just a full news channel that's all you'd talk about.
Yeah, yeah, and there've been attempts. You know, there've been movements in that direction. I think the closest we have to that is self-selecting on the internet. There's an amazing amount of positive, inspiring information to be found on the internet, and with a little time and care, you can put together a collection of websites that will give you all sorts of news that is uplifting and useful and helpful. And so that may be the way it happens. It's not so much the old model of a network, but just that people will tune more and more into the news that's helpful and the news that's positive for them.
You know, we've got just about maybe 10 minutes left on the hour here, and I was going to see, I'm not sure, we had some callers hanging on. I don't know if they're still hanging on, but we've got, let me give out the call-in numbers and see if somebody wants to give us a ring. But the numbers are 888-627-6008, or we've got another number, 530-413-4522, I know we had a couple callers hanging on the line, and I'm not. I think we lost them there. But anyway, if one pops up, I we'll bring them on, and you know, hopefully we can answer some of their questions. But we can just go on. Looks like we've lost the callers that were hanging on. I should have grabbed them earlier, but I really liked where things were going, so I skipped it. But you know, some of the things going on, now this is kind of on a different note. I'm really curious. I know over in India and Peru and a lot of these hotspots and over a lot of ashrams as well, they seem to be getting a lot of UFO activity. I'm wondering if you're having any of that in your area.
Not that I have heard of. So I can't really comment. I know that there are... several people here live in the community who have mentioned having seen them in our area, but I haven't heard anything recent. So I can't really confirm that.
Yeah, I was just curious because, you know, it seems to me it's if, you know, you have an extremely advanced being out there that might be a, you know, 1,000, 10,000, or a million years ahead of us, that they would be very spiritually and technologically advanced. And those who are holding a higher frequency or doing, you know, meditation work and things like that, it would naturally draw that kind of energy.
Yeah, it hasn't seemed to have been something we in particular, the Ananda communities, have attracted. I think that if we have attracted things in particular because of what we do, it has just been people with a deep interest in going within with meditation techniques, powerful meditation techniques like Kriya Yoga, and a real focus on meditating. Ideally, people are encouraged to meditate 2 or 3 hours a day. Morning, evening, or morning before bed. So there's a real focus on direct experience of spirit and a little bit of a de-emphasis on getting too interested in the astral phenomena that can come with that kind of awakening. And Yogananda said, you know, you don't want to get too interested in the flowers along the path. You want to remember that you're on the path. So we have a tradition of being more focused on that kind of pure, absolute experience.
I know in my experience, I was doing an all-day meditation once, and I started receiving information and actually a contact from an extremely advanced being. And, you know, I found out they were actually on a ship, and it just blew my mind. It's a long story. My sisters came up and actually saw it hovering over the ranch. And so I had to tie the two together, like the masters and the high, you know, the ultra dimensionals and things like that. But what I thought was interesting is that their message was to not look for us with your eyes, and your five senses, that you really needed to go within. And they said that they wouldn't even appear to me unless I continued with my spiritual practices. So it was quite interesting. They were very, you know, stressed very highly that, you know, it's an inward journey and that would come with the process.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. We've got, looks like we do have one caller. We've got Sharon on line two. Let's see. Hope I'm spirit.
I'm here. Hi.
Oh, welcome to the show.
Hi, I'm Sharon. Hi, guys. Say, I heard a little bit a ways back where you can't imagine living a life without like-minded, and I get that. I really do. I would like both your opinions on why some of us are isolated. You know, I've lived in like-minded communities, and that is a beautiful thing, but there are responsibilities, you know, and families, and not saying that you all avoided that or anything, but I would just like your opinion as far as those of us who are in isolated places that don't get that like-minded community and feel.
Well, I think there's a time in our lives when we may be just perfect for the community experience, and then there may be times when you need, as you say, to take care of other responsibilities. One of the kind of evolutions that our community here at Ananda has gone through was the raising of children. So when we first started, there were only a handful of small children, and the lifestyle was not particularly good for them, to be honest. They were loved and they were cherished, but the focus wasn't on families giving children time and care. The focus was really on service and building the community. And it was only after, I would say, 10, 15 years of community experience that we began to value and put more emphasis on children. We've long had our own school system, but even with that, there was another change. In addition to having our own schools, that we gave families their own space, if you will. I ended up raising four children, so it's a very real experience for me that how important it was to create a space that was a family space and not just a community space. So it may be that you didn't have an opportunity to be in a community where you could have both of those worlds, or it may be that for your own growth, you needed to, you know, take it out and make it real. Even here, we use the phrase about your spirituality is tested in the cold light of day, that it's one thing to have a nice, sweet meditation, but it's another to turn that into real action, so that if somebody is, I don't know, unpleasant to you, that you don't respond with unpleasantness back, that you're make manifest what you're feeling inside and give them compassion, even if it's silent and just a prayer, that we have to be able to do that. So I think there's a yin and a yang to it, that communities can be deep places for deep inner experience and inner learning, and then you need to take it out into manifestation. So maybe for some people, I've been fortunate, I think, that I can do both the yin and the yang within the community experience that I have, but it may be that for you, you needed to have the inner community experience or the intensity of that experience and then take it out and apply those lessons to your life.
Mm-hmm. There it is. Thanks.
All right. Looks like we've got one more caller. We've got Lon Woods. Hopefully we can get him in. We're coming up to the end of the hour here, so we can take one more quick call. Lon, are you
with us? You guys there?
Yep, we're here.
Hi, Joseph and James. Earlier you mentioned about Tai Chi being manifest, a recent manifestation of an earlier thing. And it just struck me it hit home with me. I just wanted to comment on that. I remember a previous lifetime, and it happened to be Atlantean, where I was using that energy in my work. And then I had realized that I really resonated it in this lifetime. And so it was like, I went, you guys hit it right on when you were talking about that. It was just an amazing thing. So, the whole concept about having the positive, reporting media, however you want to say it, that's just such a wonderful idea. And I just wanted to thank you guys for your wonderful show tonight.
Thanks for calling in.
Alrighty.
Thanks for calling. We're coming up to the end of the hour. So, Joseph, before we sign off, I wanted you to give a plug for the conference you're having, and then we'll use that on the way to take us out.
Yeah, if you joined the show late and didn't hear me mention it before, I'm going to be emceeing a conference Memorial Day weekend. It's called the Yuga Cycle of the Ages and Our Awakening Consciousness, and it has Joan Borisenko, Amit Goswami, Robert Schock, Christopher Dunn, and several others, including myself. And it'll be themed on the yugas. We'll be talking about the new renaissance of ancient inspiration from India and the East, informing our new expression, our new renaissance in the West. I'd also like to invite people to get my book on the yugas. If you have been interested in this discussion, a lot of what I'm drawing on, I talk about in the book. And that you can find out more about by going to theyugas.com. So you've got theyugasconference.com and theyugas.com, two different websites, but they're related. Hope you might be inspired to come. It's going to be a really wonderful conference. It's going to be limited to about 180 people, so it's going to be fairly small and intimate. You'll get a chance to interact with these teachers and presenters.
Great. Hey, well, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. Unfortunately, we're out of time, so keep up the great work and good luck with your conference.
Thank you, and you keep up the great work you're doing as well. It was a pleasure to be on the show.
All right, take care. All right, it's James Gillen signing off with As You Wish Talk Radio. Have a great evening. Watch the skies and go within.